It's 9:04 a.m. on the first day of April 2013, but no tomfoolery or jokes. This is serious business today. We have public testimony on Senate Bill 27 and House Bill 29. House Bill 4 will be carried over in the afternoon until we get the rest of our committee here. And my understanding, there's this has been scheduled for the floor for multiple days, House Bill 4, and we will do our best to get that bill out of committee in the appropriate form. So we might be in for a little later today than normal, but we'll do our best. Today will be public testimony. We've had a couple of amendments passed out by members, which is, I'm glad people have them so folks can see them, but we won't take amendments up on either of these bills. It's our intent today to facilitate public testimony, and we'll take all comers on that. So before we start, all members present are Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Osterman, Stoltz, Representative Costello, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Holmes, and Representative Munoz. Representative Thompson and Edgman and Newman will all be joining us later this morning if we're still here. Are there any things for the good of the order before we start? Any questions about today's process? Okay. And we will. We have both bills up. We'll take testimony concurrently on those. If folks can comment on both bills for the purposes of efficiency, if they want, and we will. If there are comments on both bills, we'll if you indicate that, we'll provide sufficient time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
When you say both bills, you mean SB 27 and HB 129?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
With that, look, I'm going to have we have here in committee Ms. Weisler. And we have your testimony you'd sent prior. It's included in the packet. So, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name's Lisa Weisler. I'm from Juneau, Alaska, and I am an attorney with a particular expertise in natural resource law. And I'm here just on behalf of myself and because I care. And I'm here to testify on HB 129. Now, I did send prior testimony. There are reasons I think House Bill 129 is problematic, but something happened on Friday that I think really changes the discussion. There was Alaska Supreme Court decision issued that is going to affect, I think, DNR's process for all oil and gas project reviews. To explain that, I want to talk a little bit about the current practice, which I think you heard from DNR last week about, but mostly about a comprehensive written best interest finding. It only needs to be done at the lease disposal phase of an oil and gas project. So it's only focusing on the issues that are pertaining to the lease sale phase, and it discusses future phases in more broad general terms. Now, by statute, this lease disposal finding has to include consideration of the reasonably foreseeable cumulative effects of exploration, development, production, and transportation for oil and gas. These are the later phases. And it has to include the effects on subsistence, fish, and wildlife habitat and populations, and historic and cultural resources. Now, according to prior Alaska Supreme Court decisions, a cumulative impact analysis doesn't require speculation about unknown and unpredictable future events, but it's a whole project analysis. It takes into account all aspects of a project, considering it as a whole and within the context of existing development. But like I say, at a best interest finding phase, that's limited to the information known at the time. You don't know about specific projects on the ground. And what the court ruled, and this, like I say, this just came out on Friday, so I don't know if any of you have heard about this. They ruled that the state is actually constitutionally required to consider consider cumulative impacts throughout all phases of a project. So they found that while best interest findings in future, you know, the written best interest findings aren't required in future findings, DNR is required, I'm going to quote here, this is from the case, DNR is required to continue to analyze and consider all factors material and relevant to what is in the public interest after the lease sale phase, including the cumulative impacts of the project, and to provide the public with timely and meaningful notice of its cumulative impacts assessment in order to ensure the constitutional principle of maximum use consistent with the public interest is given effect. So they're saying that you have to do cumulative impact assessments not just at the lease sale phase, but at every phase afterwards, and that there has to be public notice when the state does of that cumulative impact assessment. Now, coming to HB 129 and how the court ruling is going to affect that, you know, like in best interest finding, the exploration and development approvals in House Bill 129, they're going to occur prior to specific projects being identified. So when it comes to assessing the cumulative impacts, these approvals are going to have the same handicap as the best interest findings. They're going to take place without knowing what the potential impacts of future project activities will be. Now also, DNR has testified to their intention of ending most of the public notice on those comprehensive plans of operations for on-the-ground projects, and yet the court's requiring that the public has to be provided with timely and meaningful notice of the cumulative impacts assessment of a project. So there's going to have to be some public notice, and presumably with public comment, when a project's proposed and permitting decisions are to be made. Now, in effect, this sort of creates a hole in the law. I mean, plans of operation are comprehensive, but they don't include a cumulative impact assessment. So there's going to need to be a procedure for cumulative impact analysis and public notice when exploration and development projects are actually proposed. The court's not providing the instruction on how the state should analyze these cumulative impacts after the lease sale phases, because that's the legislature's prerogative. And in fact, Article 8, Section 2 of the Constitution, under that section, the legislature is tasked with the duty to determine the procedures necessary to meet the constitutional requirements to develop Alaska's resources for the maximum benefit of the people. So in light of all of this, it probably makes sense to table HB 129 and develop through legislation whatever procedures are needed to meet the court's ruling. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Weisler, the bill, just on first blush, by most of us who are not oil and gas experts, looked a little bit benign. So where is it in the bill that we lose public comment and over the cumulative impact statement? Because, I mean, I don't think that local communities have been irresponsible in their comments, but that's, I guess, arguable. Well, where do we lose that?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Weisler.
The bill itself really doesn't address cumulative impacts at all, because cumulative impacts are not being dealt with at the phases that the bill is addressing. In terms of loss of public notice, that's really coming through the DNR testimony. Plans of their idea for HB 129 is to do what they've called this holistic analysis of exploration and development before you actually get to specific activities. People won't know where and when and how things are going to occur. When that happens, plans of operations are issued, and even though it's not required by statute, DNR does do public notice for those plans of operation, and it's their proposal under HB 129, or their intent, I should say, to stop doing that public notice. Essentially, there just isn't anything. When I say there's a hole in the law, there isn't any way right now for doing what the court is saying, to analyze cumulative impacts on the project as a whole.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I understand what you say about the Supreme Court opinion, which seems to require the public notice that DNR doesn't want to happen, but where in this bill does the public notice disappear? Is it the part that says that even pending public notice, the project can move ahead?
Does the bill say that?
Well, it seems to say on line 12, The approval authorizes the lessee to begin exploration during the specified period. I assume that was the notice period, but.
Well,
or just, why don't you tell me? I mean, your concern is that we lose certain public notice and public comment under this bill, and maybe it's based on DNR testimony.
Well, you've stated an opinion. You want her to confirm that now, right?
Okay. Where in the bill does it limit public notice?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, I'm sorry to repeat myself, but it doesn't in the bill, and partly that's because there is no statutory requirement right now for public notice of projects. It happens because of DNR's practice. So there's no need to change a statute. It's they're changing their practice. And so that's maybe why that's a little confusing. They may be to answer that better, but that's the way I understand it, is that they'll do these broad-based approvals, and they want to have the authority to do that in order to no longer do site-specific project reviews on plan, you know, by public noticing plans of operation. And there is a reason that they do those public notice, and there is something in statute that has to do with phasing, and I don't want to go down that path. It might get a little confusing. But there, the bill itself, I guess it is potentially benign if they do these general approvals and still have public notice of a project afterwards, but they have said that that's not their intent. And the reason I feel like the bill right now, in light of the court decision, should be tabled is because of the confusion that it might create, number one. Number two, it really can't be implemented the way they've said they want to implement it, and so why put something into statute that really, you know, it's optional, but they really couldn't do the option until all the court decision issues are dealt with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weiser. I assume it's here in Juneau because it's handwritten. Mr. Sullivan, Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll speak on SB 27 first. For the record, my name is James Sullivan with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. We find SB 27 very problematic, and we hope that this committee, before they pass this bill along, can get a better idea of what this bill or what 404 primacy will actually get the state of Alaska. You haven't been given a clear understanding, in my opinion, of what you actually get. According to what I understand from earlier testimony in earlier committees, it's very apparent that if you take 404 primacy, you still will not get any navigable waters under the Rivers and Harbors Act, and nor will you get any coastline or adjacent wetlands to the coastline. That's over 33,000 miles of coastline in Alaska and all its adjacent waters. I think this is, first of all, a huge problem, and currently the only issues that have been brought before this committee on why you need 404 primacy have been the CD5 delays that occurred just a couple of years ago, and the Point Thompson delays. I think Representative Guerra spoke very well on the issues of CD5, that the Colville River, which is where the delay point occurred, will still remain under the Rivers and Harbors Act. So if we had 404 primacy just a few years ago, we still would have had these delays because the Corps will retain these rivers. I think the other problem here is that when they stopped talking about CD5 during testimony last week, they immediately pivoted and started speaking more about Point Thompson. My problem here is Point Thompson, first of all, there are no delays over 404 permitting. By some people's perspective, there might be 30 to 40 year delays over Point Thompson, but the latest big delay that occurred over litigation started by the Murkowski administration, I believe in 2006. And that is certainly did create delays, but luckily all those delays were resolved back in March 30th of last year. As soon as that all issues were resolved and everyone signed on to a project, the state and all the producers, they immediately restarted permitting process. I think actually Point Thompson case is actually an excellent case on how well the Army Corps actually does permitting. They were able to finish permitting on time this spring and summer. Colonel Listocki of the Army Corps of Engineers signed off on the Point Thompson permit in October. There was some additional permitting done by the state the following month, and Exxon started its project on time in January of this year. When you look back on Exxon's testimony that they gave in Senate Judiciary back in June of 2012, that's the actual timeline that they figured would be happening. And it played out exactly as they had hoped, showing that there really was no delay at Point Thompson this past year. I think it's very problematic for the fact that the state is taking on this process and we don't have a idea of how much it's actually going to cost the state. Currently, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Alaska District, has 54 employees and a budget of approximately $7.9 million. For the state of Alaska to take on 404 primacy, they're going to have to do as good a job. We can't take this over and say, well, we'll do it a lot differently. EPA will only hand over the keys to this program to the state if they feel that they're doing as good a job currently as the Army Corps of Engineers. They currently spend over $7 million a year doing permitting. And I think that's a huge ramp up of state employees, the size of state government, and it will be a huge increase on your operating budget, which I know currently we're spending a lot of time trying to find ways to diminish our operating budget. This bill will eventually add millions of dollars to our budget, which, if you could really define a real problem that was occurring, saying we need to spend these millions because of all the problems that are happening with 404 permitting, it's imperative that we take this on. Currently, I can't see any, and they haven't defined any problems that have occurred that 404 primacy would resolve if the state took it over. The only other issue that's been brought up earlier by Representative Wilson last week and was brought up in House Resources was the possibility of some of the problems that placer miners have had across the state, and that could easily be handled by the programmatic general permit, which Commissioner Hartig mentioned last week. It would cost a fraction of what 404 primacy would cost, and probably could resolve the issues that placer miners have across the state. So I just ask that before you take this on, and before we start going down this road, and before we start hiring employees that will not be allowed to actually issue a permit, according to Commissioner Hartig's timeline, for at least 8 to 10 years possibly, you find out exactly what you're getting and what you're not getting, and what efficiencies you can actually put in place. I'd also like to add that other states that have gone through this, because it became part of the testimony, and I know Representative Costello spoke about this, the 402 primacy that we just took over is something that could have been done in stages. So we started issuing permits on a small scale as we ramped up the program over a few years, and it took quite a few years before we actually took over complete 402 primacy. 404 is an all or nothing. So you have to have all the pieces in place, all the people there, all the capabilities before you can issue your first permit. And according to Hartig's timeline, that could take anywhere from 5 to 8. He's also said in other committees up to possibly even 10 years. But we're hiring people today before we actually know if you want to take this on. I think that's a problem.
We're probably getting to the wrap-up point, I assume.
Sure. Yes.
20 minutes on the first two witnesses.
That's fine. The only thing I'd also like to add, though, is that realize that the EPA will always be the boss of this program. If you guys spend millions of dollars taking this program on, you still have to report, and the final say is the EPA. And I think with the frustrations of people that maybe there have been delays, and I know that is frustrating, I can think it's only going to be a million times more frustrating when you start spending millions of dollars to do this program and the EPA can still say, no, we have veto authority, which they will attain if we take over 404 primacy. So I just hope this committee looks into all those issues and gets a clear idea of what this bill will actually do, because it is going to be a huge ramp up in state spending. Thank you.
Well, you
Short question. This bill would allow a study period to be initiated, and then eventually the materials would come back to the legislature for final approval. And I believe that period is about 2 years. One of the results, if we were to take over the 404 permitting for the state from the Corps of Engineers, that the state would be able to litigate appeals of permits issued by the department. Do you feel that, does SEAC have a position on state litigation versus, or state primacy over litigation versus federal, a tendency to litigate in federal courts, or have you considered that?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we are aware of that, and we know that is something that's been discussed in other committees. I want to point out, though, that even though these might be going through the state, throughout these issues, if any issue does arise, Fish and Wildlife Service, they will be going through EPA. If there is an issue that they have, and they will take it to, at the federal level, these federal organizations can actually bypass the state. So if Fish and Wildlife has an issue on a certain permit somewhere, and they say, you know, this is a big problem, they're going to take it to the EPA. So will NIMS. They'll be able to take those issues there, and if EPA still attains that veto power, I don't, you know, obviously we never know how things play out in the courtroom if it's a state or federal case, but realize that if people have issues, they can take it still to the federal organizations, and it will go through EPA. So I don't know directly how, you know, these issues might play out, but I think there's a huge cost for little reward if we take this over, because I don't think you are avoiding the organizations that might have issues right now. If that answers the question right there, it's best I can, sorry.
Thank you. We're going to move on. Did you have any comments on 27, Mr. Sullivan?
I just spoke on 27. Do you mean 129?
129.
I actually am signed up. That's all right. Mr. Chairman, I am signed up to testify on 129 also.
Why don't you take just a couple minutes?
All right. Well, on HB 129, for the record, I'm still James Sullivan with SEAC. Our biggest issue here is this change and this kind of nebulous geographic area, which we can't, which hasn't been defined for us. We also find that type of change in procedure difficult. Now, I know that Chairman Sullivan, or I'm sorry, Commissioner Sullivan, spoke about permitting issues and wanting to create, ensure a structured and efficient process. I think the problem here is that right now, and particularly in the multi-use areas, the peninsula and the Cook Inlet, this type of approach can bring huge type of problems for people if they don't understand these projects. If a project comes right now, currently, the plan is brought forth, people are able to look at the plan and comment exactly on the plan in place. If the plan in the development stage changes dramatically, you're able to make new comments on the plan. I think the problem that we have here is that in this geographic area, no matter, and we're still not sure how large or small it's going to be, if a plan is put in place in one area, I think there's an undue burden put on the public because we have to look at the plan, but we also have to look at the entire geographic area and see what issues might come into play with this particular plan. It kind of puts the idea that we have to put a little salami hat on and a crystal ball and kind of predict what might happen if they change their plans in this geographic area. And particularly in the Cook Inlet, which is obviously, we all know, a multi-use area. We think that it, this undue burden that puts on the public to have to testify is unfortunate, and I think it's going to lead to more problems than creating more efficiencies. That's all there.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Next, going to Anchorage Offnet, we have Nikos Pastos. We're going to ask five minutes tops on testimony. Please, sir, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm not sure if you can hear me.
Yeah, we've acknowledged your presence, sir. Please proceed to identifying yourself.
I'm a lifelong Alaskan resident. I was born in Anchorage. I'm on the board of directors for a conservation organization known as the Center for Water Advocacy. My comments here on behalf of the Center for Water Advocacy's membership, as well as personally for myself as an individual citizen, we're opposed to Senate Bill 27, the Wetlands Permitting Bill. And in particular, we have significant membership with tribal communities and federally recognized tribal governments and other rural citizens throughout Alaska who are very concerned about the state taking over. It's kind of a nebulous bill, Senate Bill 27. And the costs that we're concerned primarily about impacts to migratory birds, as well as adverse cumulative and aggregate impacts to the wetland ecosystem. Also, the costs are a lot of us are concerned that the costs are not quantified in this bill. So it's a very expensive undertaking that doesn't seem to have been properly measured. Furthermore, the federal agencies that create or have oversight over wetlands permitting do have an obligation or a federal trust duty to consult with tribes on a nation-to-nation basis. And very concerned in this bill and some of the others about the, it seems like it's curtailing or streamlining public participation and public notification. And so, in summary, we're opposed to Senate Bill 27 for these reasons. Also would like to put some comments in on House Bill 129.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Again, Center for Water Advocacy and myself as a citizen are opposed to area-wide oil and gas best interest findings. I guess the simple part of it is that it does not seem very workable to create a 10-year best interest finding when so many things are changing in the economic development from day to day, as well as in the climate. And I'm just thinking about weather factors, things that can affect things that could change in a 10-year period having to do with development. The public, again, Center for Water Advocacy and our membership are opposed to House Bill 129 because of the curtailment of public review of oil and gas exploration and development activities. And this one seems very nebulous, very fuzzy, not well-defined. Again, not sure of the cost, and it seems like a kind of an end run around public participation or public involvement in development activities that could potentially affect not only the subsistence economies of many rural communities, but also the commercial economies. Okay, so please oppose House Bill 129. Thank you for this opportunity.
And your opposition to both bills is noted. Appreciate your testimony, Mr. Pastos. Any questions from members? Thank you. Next, we'll go to New Exit. We have a couple people listed. We'll take them one at a time, though. We have Ms. Inna, and I will just use the first name, Samuel.
both in the village of Nuiqsut. Who wants to go first?
Hello. I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time to hear our testimony. My name is Martha Itta. I am from the village of Nuiqsut. I am the tribal administrator for our native village of Nuiqsut. On HB 27, there are a number of bills being considered in this legislative session that change the process for development throughout the state. The changes proposed in this bill will have sweeping effects across the state, and villages like mine will be greatly impacted. I live on the Colville River Delta. Our community is surrounded by oil and gas. The village of Nuiqsut is surrounded by wetlands, just like so many other villages throughout the state. Here we need permits to build a driveway if it goes through wetlands, but we also know how important that process is when an oil company wants to build a road. Often they will need to build roads, airstrips, drill pads, and more that all require wetland permits. These permits are a way to make sure our lands are not destroyed, so they are very important. Equally important is input from the public and local residents to include critical input into these projects. Currently, the Army Corps of Engineers administers wetland dredge and fill permits. When projects will have a big impact to our surroundings, there are ways for my tribe to be involved in the wetlands permitting process, most notably through the federal requirement to hold government-to-government consultation with my tribe. Nothing binds the state agencies to do the same, and this bill does not address the major changes. In order to protect the rights of our tribes and the public to have required and meaningful input, I urge the Finance Committee to vote against SB 27. That's my testimony for SB 27. I also have comments for SB 129.
Okay, please just proceed on, and we'll separate the bills. And
okay. SB 129 proposes sweeping effects across the state when it comes to oil and gas development, and villages like mine will be greatly impacted. This bill will remove Alaskans' right to participate in, oversee, or scrutinize natural resource decisions. We need to ensure resource decisions are made in the best interest of Alaskans, and we could not guarantee this if this bill is passed. My community in Nuiqsut is already greatly impacted by oil and gas development. In February of 2012, our village experienced a blowout from Repsol, and after pushing for answers, nobody came to our aid, not state of Alaska, to come help us and give us answers and guide us into what to do in case of a blowout. Our air quality is badly infected. After that blowout, they finally admitted that benzene was in exceedance of the national level, and benzene is the number one cancer-causing chemical for leukemia. After that happened, we had buried my two-year-old nephew who died of leukemia. And now our village, we have another child who is in treatment for leukemia. Offering blanketed approval for millions of acres to remain effective for 10 years will not ensure safe and appropriate decisions are made in that time frame. Decisions for the Beaufort Nearshore area, North Slope, and Foothill regions, totaling around 11 million acres, will have major implications to my and other North Slope communities. one best interest finding for the North Slope 5 million acres cannot cover the varied landscape of the region. The Arctic is changing incredibly fast with melting permafrost, eroding coastlines, and more, making a 10-year time frame for approved activity too long and unpredictable. Also, as non-conventional methods will be used in the North Slope and throughout the state, including proposed shale oil fracturing. Public input cannot account for future technologies brought to the slope 10 years in advance. Projects like this and others come deserve robust public reviews when the Department of Natural Resources is considering plans of operation. As is required now, the Department of Natural Resources allows for public notice and comment not only on leasing, but in later phases for exploration and development. These later phases are when location, site-specific plans, and cumulative impacts can be identified. However, this bill would remove public involvement in the later phases. The public would no longer be allowed to participate in individual permitting decisions. This bill also does not include any standards for the director to make exploration or development approvals on this area-wide scale. That, paired with only minimal public involvement early on, does not ensure natural resource decisions are made with the best interests of Alaskans. With these concerns, I urge the Finance Committee to vote against SB 2059 and SB 129. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Etta, and sounds like you might have had prepared testimony. If you want to provide that, we'll put that in the public record as you've prepared it, if that's your wish.
Yes.
Okay, just send it to the House Finance Committee, and we will make sure that's put in the public record. And I'm going to take a stab at this. Is Mr. Kunaknuna also testifying?
My name is Sam Kunangano.
Okay, thank you.
And, you know, I am opposed to SB 27. I'll make this short and sweet over here. It takes away our right to voice out on oil development around our area. Thank you. I can't talk.
And you're also opposed to both bills, sir? Is that reflected?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
We are right to voice out, especially with the oil development around our area in North Pitt.
I wanted to make an opportunity to accurately record your position on the record. So it is opposed to both. Thank you for coming out today, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we'll go to Barrow. We have... see if I get closer on this one. Rosemary Atnungarak? Nungarnook?
Hi, this is Rosemary Atnungarak, and I want to thank the Finance Committee for taking...
I had no chance.
And this is really important for us who are living in the Arctic, who live in much of our lands, which are wetlands. Our participation has effectively... voice concerns that show changes to our lands and waters that affect our traditional way of life, affects our lands and waters being changed by oil and gas, and have a tremendous amount of impacts to our way of life, and already identified ways that impacts have occurred that affected fishing and living and caribou hunting. And if you take away our ability to effectively participate and bring our concerns, our ability to function through conflict or arising are very limited. We work in the Arctic and to try to bring our resources in to try to address some of our concerns, depending upon activities near
Are you still there, ma'am? Pardon? We'll come back if we regain connection. So till then, we'll go to Fairbanks at the Legislative Information Office. We have Mr. Metz. Are you there, sir?
Yes. This is Paul Metz, 3510 Rosie Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99709. I'd like to speak in support of the passage of Senate Bill 27 with one important reservation. The findings section notes that there are millions of bodies of water and tens of millions of acres of wetlands within the state of Alaska's boundaries. What is the legal definition of wetlands? Excuse me. Wetlands are lands that contain soils which are saturated during the growing season and the soil temperature is greater than 5 degrees centigrade, 50 centimeters below the surface. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers 1987 manual. Thus, if the active layer of permafrost is less than 50 centimeters, then by definition, the soils are not wetlands. Large areas of Alaska are underlined by permafrost with active layers less than 50 centimeters. Thus, they should be, by definition, not classified as wetlands. The courts have ruled that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers must abide by their rules, guidelines, and definitions. Yet, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has classified areas of shallow permafrost as wetlands. Is the state of Alaska waiving its right to challenge the Corps of Engineers' classification of shallow permafrost as wetlands by agreeing to assume regulatory primacy? If the state of Alaska cannot unequivocally state that it is not relinquishing its right to challenge the Corps' classification of shallow permafrost regions as wetlands, then the legislature should not pass the bill. On the other hand, if the state can, their position will not be compromised with respect to the jurisdiction of wetlands, then I think it's in the best interest of the state to locally manage laws and regulations that affect the local communities in Alaska as well as the state. Thank you.
And did you have any comments on House Bill 129 as well? You don't have to. I just want to give you the opportunity if you did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I do not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Metz. Next, we'll go to the Cordova Legislative Information Office. Ms. Carpenter.
Did you hold? Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Please.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, this is Kristen Carpenter. I'm the Executive Director of the Copper River Watershed Project, and I wanted to say good morning, Co-Chair Osterman and Co-Chair Stoltz and other committee members, and I appreciate your taking the time to listen to us this morning. I'd like to urge the committee to vote no on SB 27, and I think it's because of the impact that it stands to have on the wetlands and I think also on the state's finances. I'm the executive director of the Copper River Watershed Project. I have been for the past 14 years. I'm not an attorney. I have done a lot of construction projects and some construction management, so I have some, my experiences from on the ground work. And what our group does is we encourage decision makers to make decisions that take fish habitat into account, and we promote sustainable economic development for the Copper River drainage. And what that involves in our region is a lot of fish habitat work because we have a commercial salmon economy, a subsistence salmon economy, and a sport fish salmon economy. We've carried out several construction projects that have to do with restoring fish passage so fish can get to upstream habitat for spawning, which is important for maintaining productivity. And so as a result of doing that work, we're pretty familiar with the permitting process. I think I wanted to echo the comments that were made by the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council because it just seems like this is a huge fiscal undertaking adding to the state's fiscal responsibilities. And I did look at the fiscal note, and it does show that it's a wash, but I, given what the Corps of Engineers does now, it's really hard to see how that could be the case. And I think this has the potential to have a huge impact on rural Alaska. I just listened to Martha Issa talk about the conditions in Nuiqsut, and I don't understand how DEC is going to review site conditions in the hundreds of rural villages that are like that and get out there to see conditions on the ground and make permitting decisions. And I'm also not a biologist, but what I have learned on this job is that wetlands and small streams are critical for sustaining wild salmon fisheries. That's where a lot of key spawning and rearing activity takes place. The big rivers are migratory channels, but all those small streams are really, really important, and it's critical not to, to lose those. And salmon fisheries are our largest renewable resource for the state, statewide. They employ more people statewide than any other industry. It's not to say that it's the highest dollar value, but it employs more people per capita than any other industry. So your decision has the capacity to injure that sector pretty severely, and I don't think it would show up in 5 years, and it might not show up in 10 years, but I urge you to take the long view. Do we want salmon runs to support family businesses, the set netters, and the people on the Yukon River, and all the people in coastal Alaska and communities like Cordova and Southeast? Do we want salmon runs to support those family businesses, those mom-and-pop operations 50 years from now? And I guess if the legislators, if you feel that there are problems with permitting, I would say bring back coordinated permitting that we had under the Coastal Zone Program. I understand that, that people had concerns about elements of that program, but I think the coordinated permitting helped a lot of small-scale projects, and now anybody who wants to do permitting has to go to all those agencies individually, and I think that's a huge burden on the on developers. So I want to thank you for your opportunity to testify, and I urge the committee to vote no on SB 27. Thanks for your time.
And Ms. Carpenter, while you're here, did you have any comments or that you wish to state on House Bill 129?
I would just echo what, reinforce what others have said already. Thank you.
Most others?
Well, the SEAC comments, okay. And the folks from Nuiqsut and Rosemary from...
I just wanted to make sure it was on the record. We wouldn't want your position to be misinterpreted or whatever.
Right.
All right. Thank you. Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you. I have my question is this. Have you had experience with the current permitting process, where they've ruled in ways that you don't like, where they've ruled in ways that you do like, and in the end, have the decisions been made in a timely basis?
You said ruled or rolled?
Ruled.
Okay, I just think.
Yeah. Have you been on both sides of Army Corps' decisions, like them, not like them, but in the end, have they been timely decisions?
Yes, I have. I have. I've been in the situations like when we do our culvert replacement projects, they have issued the permits that we needed, and they were pretty, they've always been good to work with. We've done work here in Cordova and up on the McCarthy Road. In fact, we coordinated a lot of pre-permitting phase planning meetings so that when DOT even went to the permitting agencies, they already knew what the request was going to be. I've also been in the situation where I felt like they weren't erring, or not erring, they weren't deciding the way we had hoped. There was a person here in Cordova who bought a chunk of land from the university and raised every tree on both sides of a stream. And we couldn't get, and the stream wasn't cataloged. It was not a cataloged fish and game in the Anadromous Waters catalog. And the Corps of Engineers maintains that this person wasn't, you know, that they had the right to do that, and they couldn't stop them. And so they've stopped them since then, because after they raised every tree, they started pushing fill into the creek channel, and that was illegal. But anyway, so yes, I have been on both sides of it.
And then
Representative Guerra.
Just the follow-up and one more. The follow-up is, have they come in a timely decision? And then just one more. We've heard that the Army Corps people are sort of people from Washington, D.C., but, I mean, are the Army Corps people who live locally, or are they Army Corps people who live outside of Alaska?
Oh, no, I've never dealt with anybody from D.C., except when we applied for a grant. But, no, all the people that I've dealt with are, like, John Klutz in Anchorage, who's a long-time Corps of Engineers employee. I mean, I think he's been there for 30 years. And, yeah, and Melissa Reardon up in Fairbanks and Serena Sweet. And, no, they're all Alaska folks that we deal with for permitting and requests for whether it's even in the Army Corps jurisdiction. So, and in fact, we did, yeah, we just submitted a grant proposal with the Corps, in partnership with the Corps of Engineers, and I worked with somebody who is from, has been in Anchorage for quite a while. So, yeah, no, it's all been local folks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guerin. Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Mm-hmm. We're going to take one more swing back to Barrow. We see if, I'm just going to call her Rosemary. Are you, she's... Is there anybody here from the public online or at the LIOs that we've missed or has decided they want to say something? Anybody here in Juneau? Anywhere on the system? We're getting a negative acknowledgement from the teleconference coordinator here in Juneau. So with that, we'll close the public testimony on Senate Bill 27 and House Bill 129. We have some folks from the Department of Law and DNR online, and we have folks here. Mr. Deputy Commissioner Fogles, did you wish to put anything on the record at this time? Representative Wilson, or do members of this committee wish to ask them any questions?
Well, I'm not sure who the question goes to, but this is Mr. Metz made the question about challenging the definition of permafrost and whether or not our decision here...
The definition of wetlands?
Wetlands, I'm sorry. Well, whether permafrost is wetlands. So I don't know whether they can answer that question now, but I know that is a big issue because basically everything in Alaska at this point with the Corps is wetlands.
We have folks from the Department of Law. We have Mr. Crawford in Anchorage, and then we have Mr. Fogles here. Does somebody want to take a stab at that?
Welcome. Chair Stoltz, my name is Ruth Hamilton Hesse. I'm with the Alaska Department of Law, and I work with DNR and DEC on this SB 27, which is what, through the chair, Representative Wilson's question goes to. Under the Clean Water Act 404, for purposes of what the states will gain jurisdiction over, were we to pursue primacy after evaluating the program, there is accepted from the jurisdiction navigable waters, waters that are tidally influenced, and wetlands adjacent to those navigable waters and tidally influenced waters. This goes back to the Commerce Clause and whether something's susceptible to foreign or interstate commerce. With those exceptions, the states are to gain control over waters and wetlands within their jurisdictions, their state boundaries. And I mean, we can go look to other statements that were made in legislative history as well as in EPA guidance documents that do reflect that the states are to assume control over the majority of waters and wetlands within their boundaries beyond those that I've just explained or accepted. Does that make sense?
I think the question had to do more with Mr. Metz had talked about an evolving definition due to different environmental circumstances. Is that what the members understood? Much like, I guess, if there was the big quake in California, would Arizona under all of a sudden be under coastal management? Anyway.
It's true, man.
Did you represent Wilson?
Yeah, I think the overall is that we know that the Corps has not looked at their own definition of what wetlands. So they've made it to where pretty much all of the state of Alaska, because of the permafrost, can be qualified. So I think what Mr. Metz is asking is, because we don't agree with that, if we take over the primacy, you know, do we give up that option of fighting that portion of it, that, you know, wetlands is not every part of Alaska?
Certainly that would be part of the discussion during evaluating whether we want to take on primacy. It is a changing landscape. The Supreme Court has visited the question of what are wetlands generally speaking, and whether or not the federal agencies have properly promulgated what are federal jurisdictional wetlands. And I think that will be part of our discussion while we're looking at primacy. We think that there should be a line at which permafrost lands are not considered wetlands. So, I mean, that's the state's overall belief that not all wetlands that might have been identified by Fish and Wildlife Service are necessarily federally jurisdictional wetlands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that we're not giving up, you know, I agree with what we're trying to do here, but I want to make sure we're not giving up other rights, you know. It's really my concern.
And we're vigilant on those.
Thank you.
For the state.
Just before I go to Representative Guerra and Kawasaki, what's the bigger concern? Is it changes in the political environment or evolutions in the physical environment?
I'm probably not the best person to speak to that particular question.
Mr. Fogel?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. I think Ruth Hamilton Hesse kind of outlined, the intent is clearly from the Clean Water Act for us to assume most of the wetlands in Alaska. That's the position we're entering into this process with. And as she said, that's going to be one of the major issues that we're going to be evaluating over the next year or two as part of this. I think there are political considerations and changing administrations on the federal side, and I think that's one of the main reasons that we'd like to have that or look at having that regulatory authority here based in Alaska. I don't know if that sort of gets to the point.
And for the record, that was Mr. Fogels. He's a deputy commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
We got it in. Representative Guerra and then Kawasaki.
Mr. Chair, just a couple questions. I forget the Assistant Attorney General's name. What is your name again?
It's Ruth
Hamilton Hesse. Okay.
I guess we're now into three names here in our house, too, so go ahead.
Let me see if I can boil it down and see if we're accurate here. You said the Supreme Court is in the middle of deciding whether or not states can regulate wetlands, and that's a Commerce Clause issue. But whether or not we take over primacy or not, if the Supreme Court rules that states can define what are wetlands away from navigable waters inside state lands, we'd be able to do that even if we didn't take over primacy. Isn't that true? That we'd be able to define wetlands if the Supreme Court comes out our way?
Through the chair, I'm not sure what you mean by out of
our way. Well, on the Commerce Clause. So if the Commerce Clause allows the state if the Commerce Clause is interpreted to allow the state to regulate their own wetlands, then the state would be able to define what are wetlands. And if the Commerce Clause, according to the Supreme Court, doesn't, as seems to be the rule right now, then we won't. But regardless, taking over primacy wouldn't, am I right that taking over primacy wouldn't affect that analysis on whether or not the state can define what are state wetlands away from navigable waters? The primacy just doesn't matter on that.
DC has the prerogative to determine how to regulate waters that might be determined by DEC to be wetlands. So certainly, I'm not sure that I'm answering your question.
Well, let me ask it again so we understand it. Representative Wilson had a concern that the federal government is defining wetlands too broadly. Regardless of whether or not we take primacy over or not, depending on what the Supreme Court rules on the Commerce Clause, will taking over primacy take away the state's right to define what are wetlands?
Generally, no. I don't believe that's
okay.
That inhibits the state's prerogatives with regard to that.
Okay. And then a question for Mr. Fogels, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Guerra.
In the presentation the other day, the examples that were given over and over and over again for the need for the state to take over primacy were CD5, which we know is a navigable water, so isn't going to be regulated by this rule anyway. And we all agreed that the CD5 decision took way longer than it should have. But that wouldn't be regulated. And then we heard testimony today that the other example that DEC or the DNR presented was Point Thompson has taken a long. There was some permitting delay at Point Thompson, but we've been told that that was litigation related. So, please tell me what your view is on that.
That was from Mr. Sullivan's testimony from SEAC. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to make sure we're accurate in our record.
And then also just on Point Thompson, and isn't some of Point Thompson also navigable water related, so then even permitting won't apply there too?
Representative Guerra through the chair, and Ed Fogels, Deputy Commissioner of DNR. There were permitting delays at Point Thompson, a year, year and a half. It was throughout the whole permitting process, including the NEPA process. And we were there. We were managing that process. We were coordinating it. It was delayed at least a year and a half. Maybe we came really close to losing 2 years on Point Thompson throughout the EIS process. And then at the end of the EIS process, we were all sitting on the edge of our seats waiting for the Corps to issue that 404 permit. And we came so close to losing yet another construction season. So, yeah, there definitely were issues with Point Thompson.
Through the chair, though.
Representative Guerra.
I understand there are problems with the EIS process taking a long time, but the EIS process is still going to happen anyway, right?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's actually one of the things that we're going to have to evaluate as we go forward with this primacy process. Is if the federal agency no longer has a federal action involved, then they will no longer be doing the NEPA process. It's only if there's a federal hook, so to speak. In the permitting process, and I think most of these large projects are likely to have some federal hooks. There may be some NEPA action, but in this instance, if the state had primacy, and if the wetlands within the Point Thompson project footprint were delegated to the state, then the Corps may not have been involved in doing an EIS. Now, with respect to the Point Thompson project itself, we haven't actually taken a specific look to see, and we don't actually know at this point what specific wetlands we would be delegated to, but again, those are adjacent to coastal areas and navigable waters. Part of Point Thompson gets pretty close to coastal areas, so part of it might have been not delegatable to the state, but we don't know that at this point. Our guess is that a good part of Point Thompson may very well have been delegated to the state had we had primacy.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just on that point, because I had a note with Ed, ? Point Thompson could have had primacy. Can you elaborate a little more? Would it have been that the total project would have been under an EIS, or parts of it would be? I'm just trying to gather an idea of what projects the state would take under primacy versus what would not be under primacy.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, right now I don't think I can give you a really clear answer to that. I mean, that's the whole point of this bill, is to go forward and seek the answers to those kinds of questions, right? I mean, we don't know, we can't draw you a map right now of exactly which wetlands we would get jurisdiction over and which wetlands we can't. I think we've tried to make that very clear in all our testimony on this. That's the point of going forward, to work with the federal government and the federal agencies to figure out which wetlands we would actually get delegated. I mean, the Clean Water Act has the exclusion language in it, and passed statements by EPA shortly after the Clean Water Act was implemented clearly state that they anticipate states getting primacy over the majority of wetlands within their state boundaries. So that's as far as we can take any kind of determination of what wetlands we may or may not get. On Point Thompson, again, I think there likely might be some wetlands that we, in that project footprint, that we might not get jurisdiction over, and there are others that we probably would. And then as far as whether there would be an EIS or not, again, those issues are a little hard to determine without knowing exactly which wetlands we would have jurisdiction over. If it was a simple project and the state had jurisdiction over all the wetlands within that project footprint, then perhaps there would be no federal hook for an EIS that would be required. Although the state, under its 404 program, if we assume primacy, we would have to go through the 404B1 process, which would be an environmental analysis to make sure we're picking the least damaging alternative.
Thanks. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
I guess the trouble for me on this bill is that we don't know what's going to be under it. And has it ever been that a state has negotiated first what the agreement would be before putting in place the people and the? I mean, can we do that?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, and I may have Lynn Kent, Deputy Commissioner of DEC, join me here, but I think our intent is to get a much more clarity in what we would actually get delegated to us before we would come forward with an application package, before we would come back to the legislature for additional statutory language, before we would even go forward and promulgate regulations or ask for budget to run the program. I think we would really all need to understand with much greater clarity what wetlands we would have jurisdiction over and which ones we wouldn't. And we would be having those discussions with the EPA and with the Army Corps of Engineers, and we're actually starting to have those discussions right now already.
So I guess it sounds like you're already going through the process of trying to identify what the state would retain under primacy and versus what the federal government would have. So I guess, do we need to have a bill this year that gets us further down the road, or is this something that can be negotiated out prior to implementation of this bill?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I mean, our discussions so far have been very, very preliminary with the federal agencies, just setting the stage. We need to find out what we actually need to do to answer these questions. Those have been the topics at our meetings. Actually, the EPA has told us already that they have looked at our proposed fiscal note for this bill and think that we have set a good resource level to ask for to start going forward and answering these questions. So that's sort of where we're at right now with our discussions, making sure we're getting the tools in place, the resources to answer these questions and to do this cost benefit analysis.
I had a permit or the permafrost question to go
yes,
back.
Yes, go ahead.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The on the permafrost, just to go back to what that is, just so that the committee's clear on it too. So is it the understanding that permafrost and permafrost wetlands, I mean, I guess the definition's sort of not really there yet. Would this bill address all permafrost, or is it not addressing permafrost? This is specifically for the placer miners up in the Fairbanks region. Was it your understanding that this bill would address a certain number, a certain level, depth of permafrost, or is it just sort of we're not really sure yet?
We're going to have this issue back before us. If you can either answer it on the fly or try to come back with a more contemplative answer. What your call, Mr. Fogles?
I might. My name is Lynn Kent. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Is it all right if I provide an answer to the question?
If you want to do on the fly, go ahead.
Okay. What this bill does, is allow the state to look at the potential for primacy. And primacy can only be, with the exceptions noted in the Clean Water Act, for waters of the U.S. And waters of the U.S. are defined in the Clean Water Act and in implementing regulations and via court cases. It's my understanding that there is nothing in this bill that would prohibit the state from continuing to question the federal reach of what they consider to be waters of the U.S.
That was a little bit of a non sequitur to the question we were just on regarding definitions of wetlands, so but we're dealing
Mr.
with the
Chairman.
Government. Go ahead.
Thank you. Wetlands are considered waters of the U.S., if that helps.
Well, I, Mr. Fogles, do you think it's probably in your interest to come back with a more fleshed-out definition and the applicability of it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Or do you want that last definition to stand as our understanding? That's the rhetorical.
Yeah.
And then
Representative Voss,
I had a follow-up on that.
Just very briefly, our co-chair has been waiting.
It was mentioned at the very beginning that there might, specifically for placer miners in the Fairbanks district, that there might be already a useful tool in programmatic permitting. Can you explain that and why we don't use that more actively?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, there is a tool, the programmatic general permit, that we theoretically have the authority to take over right now that we've actually been looking at potentially using for certain classes of activities. Typically, they permit activities that have lower level of impact and recurring, very similar types of impacts. And we think that placer mining may actually be something that fits into that model. But I think, as we mentioned before, there are a number of tools that states can use to get more control over wetlands permitting within their boundaries. Primacy is one of those tools, maybe the potential biggest one. Programmatic general permits, that's another tool. We're going to look at all these tools. So even if we don't end up deciding to go for primacy at some point, we're still going to go for these other tools, and my guess is that we are going to get some of these other tools.
Thank you.
Thank you. And before I go to our co-chair, I'd like to welcome Representative Thompson, who's joined us. You don't look at all like a guy who's probably started his journey at 4 a.m. this morning. So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, Ed, you've used the word twice now, I've heard you say, that the hook on the federal government has on EIS. And I think you said also that at Point Thompson had the state had primacy, there may not have needed a federal EIS, but that you'd had the ability from state regulations or state law to do an abbreviated EIS, or that part I kind of got lost a little bit on.
Mr. Fogles.
Representative Osterman, through the chair. I think to be real clear, I shouldn't say or leave the committee with the impression that we would not have had to do an EIS for Point Thompson. At this point, as I said, we're not exactly sure which wetlands we might get delegated, which ones we won't. Again, my guess is that maybe at Point Thompson, perhaps some of those wetlands still would have been under federal jurisdiction. Some would have been under ours. So if some would have been under federal jurisdiction, then quite likely there would have been an EIS required for Point Thompson anyway. I think that if we have our own program, our delegated program, we have authority over some of those wetlands. In the instance of an EIS, our hope is that we would be in a much stronger position to be a cooperating agency on that EIS, and that another one of those tools that we would have. Again, as far as whether a particular project may need an EIS or not, that is something that's what we have to sort of really look at very carefully as we go forward with the cost-benefit evaluation. But there are procedures under the Clean Water Act, and if we get primacy delegated to us for those wetlands, we still have to go through a process that where we have to analyze the impacts of that action.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah. Your statements have made me a little nervous, but I think we can talk about that later.
Chair, just
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, and maybe I'd appreciate number one if you came back with somebody who was involved in that Point Thompson litigation, or have them online. That'd be helpful next time. But I was given, and frankly, something from the Army Corps, and I'll share it with you. And maybe you'll have to respond when you come back. But it says that over 80% of the general permits that people apply for at the Army Corps decided in less than 60 days, that less than 1% of the permit requests have been denied. And I'm wondering, is that an accurate representation? Do you not know? And then B, given that, is this really worth the kind of money that you're asking us to spend?
Representative Guerra, through the chair. I want to say a couple words on that, but then I'd like to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Lynn Kent, because she's taken a pretty close look at that presentation. But again, I want to start by saying that it's not all about any kind of backlog or timeliness that the Corps might have. It's about the quality of the permitting as much as anything, about the types of stipulations that they may put on those permits, and what kind of mitigation that they require for those permits. Those are equally, if not even of greater importance, and we believe that the state would have much greater control over those two facets if we had primacy. And I guess with that, Lynn, do you want to sort of add to the pie chart there?
Certainly. Again, this is Lynn Kent, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Environmental Conservation. I think, Representative Gehr, what you may be referring to is a Corps of Engineers pie chart that was part of a presentation that the Corps gave to another legislative committee. It's certainly not my intent to be critical of the Corps of Engineers, but we get a little bit different view when we look at this pie chart. When they look at the average days for processing a permit, they're looking at it from the time they consider a permit application to be complete. And in some cases, that effort of going back and forth with a permit applicant to satisfy the Corps that the application is complete can be months or even years. So these dates are from the date that the Corps of Engineers has deemed the application complete. When we look at this chart, let's first look at the general permits. These are permits that are designed to authorize a lot of different dredge and fill activities that are very minor, small in scope, with very limited cumulative impacts. So the permit is done, it's gone through a public notice period, and then over a period of time, people with a small project that fit the constraints of that general permit apply to be covered under it. It should be a very quick process for them to say, I want to be covered under this existing permit. So when we look at this chart, yes, 84% of those projects are permitted in less than 60 days. But what it also means is that in FY12, there were 109 permits, authorizations under general permits for small projects that took more than 60 days. We don't know how much more because we haven't had those kinds of conversations with the Corps of Engineers yet. For individual permits, that's the green part of the pie chart that you have there. Again, 67% of the permits were issued in less than 120 days. To us, that also means that 33% of the large projects took more than 120 days for the Corps of Engineers to permit. And again, we don't know how long. We don't know if it was one day more or 3 years more. So that's the kind of information that we would want to look at as we evaluate the core process and what we might do to do a better job in terms of getting permits out in a timely way. And again, as Deputy Commissioner Fogel said, I want to reiterate, seeking primacy for the state is not just about the backlog or how long it takes to get permits out the door. It's in part ensuring that that the state has an appropriate role in the permitting, that we're setting the priorities and how the decisions are made, and that we're not causing 134 projects to take more than 4 months to permit. That represents real jobs to Alaskans that are delayed if we don't get those permits out in a timely way.
Yeah. And thank you. Representative Munoz will be the last question. We have Representative Gehr, we have other members of the committee.
Thank you. Recently, within the last 4 or 5 years, the Kensington Mine here in Juneau received its 404 permit, and then it was challenged by the EPA, and the issue was litigated all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Would that process or the result have been different if the state had had primacy, I mean, in terms of how it was litigated?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, again, without actually, I can't give you a 100% clear answer without having gone through our the sort of this cost-benefit analysis. But if you look at the types of wetlands that were involved in the Kensington project, it was a very small lake up high on a mountainside. Clearly, no commercial navigation going on there. So, I would say that the chances, in my view, my professional opinion, the chances are probably pretty high that a lot of those wetlands involved in the project would have been delegatable to the state. Again, without having gone through this process, I can't tell you with 100% certainty, but that's certainly the type of wetland we'd be looking at to try and get primacy for. So in that particular case, very well would have had primacy. So, and again, one of the big benefits of potentially having the state program is that administrative challenges and judicial challenges stay in Alaska. They don't leave. And again, we're in no way trying to denigrate the Corps in this process. They are Alaskans that work on this. I've worked with many of them for a lot of my career. They're good people. They work hard. We're just saying that, you know, an Alaskan process that gets the challenge to stay in Alaska, that would be good for Alaskans.
Given that you're and welcome, Representative Newman, I guess we'll come back to this question. We'll have these same folks back. Floor's in less than 5 minutes. We'll continue our philosophical discussion about whether the feds are really our friends if they're here to help us. That seems to be the underlying. And I think I understand your position. You're going to be more, probably more constrained in your day-to-day working relationship, and it's our role to probably be more engaged on some of those political and policy discussions. So with that, we will set this bill, these bills aside, and come back at a date very in the near future. Our rest of the schedule, we'll bring House Bill 4 back. We have amendments submitted by members of the committee. We will take those up. We will do our best to dispense with that bill. I think everything else is paralyzed in this process until we do, so I guess we'll plow forward. So with that, thank the public who participated today, and thanks to the various departments of administration and the members for the questions. With that, we will stand in adjournment.